The Water Values Podcast, session 133.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thanks so much for joining me. Have an absolutely fantastic show for you. You're really going to enjoy this one. We have Jeff Keitlinger with the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. He does a great job talking about resiliency, both from a water supply kind of diversity perspective, as well as from an infrastructure perspective, talking about, you know, seismic activity, wildfires, things of that nature. And he also does a great job talking about regionalism on both a macro and a micro level, kind of micro within kind of intra-metropolitan and on a macro level within the Colorado River Basin. Very interesting stuff. I think you're going to find it very, very useful and very insightful on Jeff's part, because he does an absolutely amazing job explaining what Metropolitan does in these areas. We also have Reese Tisdale with us for another Bluefield on Tap segment. Reese is going to give us some insights into, conference season. You know, so ACE was a while ago. We have WEFTEC coming up. So it's going on right now, actually. So there's all kinds of things going on. Reese gives us some great insights into what kinds of programs are going on and who's putting them on. Just has some interesting analytics on that stuff. So I think you're really going to enjoy Reese's Bluefield on Tap segment. So here we go with the little housekeeping we typically do. Last time I was in a bit of a rush, so I wasn't able to get to the latest 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And this is from Greg, UCLA. He says in the title line, very informative and diverse guests. And his narrative is, there are a few good water podcasts out there now, but this is the best from a utility perspective and from a social science perspective, which is where I am most interested. You can also go back to the archives, and most episodes remain relevant despite time of taping. Greg Pierce, UCLA Luskin Center for Innovation, at Greg S. Pierce. Greg, thank you so much. That one really means a lot, because obviously UCLA Luskin Center for Innovation, prestigious institution, and having that type of praise from an individual there is great. So, Greg, thank you so much. Terrific rating and review. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, would really appreciate it if you go on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever podcast directory you listen to the show on, and leave a rating and a review. The reviews are important, because just like Greg did, he told listeners why they ought to listen to the Water Values Podcast. With that, let's get on to the Bluefield on Tap segment with Reese Tisdale. So here we go. Well, Reese, welcome back to another Bluefield on Tap segment. Great to have you. How's things going?
Things are good. Things are good, Dave. I guess we'll probably talk a little bit about this conference season.
Yeah. In terms of conference season, what's kind of going on at all these conferences? First off, what conferences are you going to, or have you been at, and kind of what's the vibe at those conferences?
I was just at the Water Reuse Conference Symposium in Austin, which was a good conference. I've been to that a number of times year over year, and it's not getting any smaller, I can tell you that. There were probably 600 people there, and a lot of my attention was focused on one was sort of industrial and commercial reuse, looking sort of beyond the municipal sector, but also a big part of the discussion was decentralized water or wastewater treatment and reuse for individual facilities. That could have been just me, but I think where I was going and who I was talking to, but that seemed to be a key theme. And then the next one coming up is WEFTEC, which starts next week.
Yeah, the big one.
Yeah, it's 32,000 people.
That's a lot of people. How much water that will 32,000 people use during WEFTEC?
At the ACE conference, which is more water focused in Las Vegas, they had a water main break in the hotel.
Yeah, there's a lot about that. So kind of what are we people talking about? Obviously, water reuse, they're talking about reuse, but what are the big kind of themes running through these conferences that you're noticing?
I think, I hate to beat the same old drum, but, data and analytics, or digital water, as we call it, keeps coming up. I sat in on the CEO panel at Water Reuse. That was a big part of the discussion. I think the bigger challenge of that is, you know, particularly among municipalities, part of the discussion is who's going to do it. You know, if you're looking at all these water systems, you know, who's out there proactively or even actively deploying these solutions. Like I said, I think the smaller, there's a growing interest among even municipalities to some extent about the impact of decentralized wastewater treatment, because what's happening is commercial and industrial users are starting to manage these things on their own, and they're, I'd say, incrementally, I don't want to say, it's not like it's a huge wave, but they're less reliant on the municipal systems, at least to the extent they can be. So that came up time and time again. I think one of the disconnects, though, is that it's between the municipality and the industry in many cases. Even at the industrial level, they say, oh, it's too expensive. But there is a cost-benefit in many cases for the municipality, whether it be saving on capital investment for new wastewater treatment as demand grows, and they definitely have a need and an interest to stay involved in those decisions. So, still seems to be a little bit of a disconnect. The WEFTEC conference coming up, you know, it, like I said, it's 32,000 people. It's going to be big. One of the things that I thought was interesting is we prepare Bluefield, we try to figure out, okay, who's going to be there, what's happening, what are people talking about, just even in the presentations. So I just put out some quick research to just analyze who are the companies and really who's influencing the discussion. And it was interesting just to look company by company.
Yeah, so kind of what's the general nature of the speakers and who's talking?
Presentations and panels that are being given at the conference, you know, one by one. We looked at the companies, the people, the titles, and the topics, and engineering firms. If you look at the top 25, the big engineering firms led by Brown and Caldwell, they're 16 of the top 25. Then you get, you know, some utilities and municipalities, a couple of others that sort of make up the difference. But that's not a surprise. And, you know, particularly in the U.S. and if not elsewhere, engineering firms really, I don't want to say dictate, but they have a heavy influence on what is happening in the market. I was just surprised at just the number. So, like I mentioned, Brown and Caldwell, they're on 40 presentations or panels, almost 39, I think, to be exact, according to our count. And it's pretty significant. Out of 850 presentations, it's pretty big. And there's a lot of time and effort that goes into these papers. It's mostly wastewater focused, and in 75% of the presentations are really on technology, which is something that I found interesting. So the rest of it is sort of left to, you know, the costs and economics of you know, systems, and very little discussion on business models, which is an area we're focused on, and that was kind of what I was looking for, quite honestly.
Yeah, well, with all the discussion about P3s, that it just seems to predominate how the public sector needs to tap that private capital. I guess I'm a little surprised that there is not more there aren't more offerings at WEFTEC on P3 and like you say, kind of the business model aspect of it.
Events, but also even within the various committees. I know there's a lot of real discussion that happens at those levels that we all don't get to see. But at the same time, I agree. I thought, you know, we had the analysts go through everything, and I said, wow, 75% is technical focus. But technology, quite honestly, is not the issue. But, I mean, I think that's been our, you know, our standing line for some time at Bluefield, and that is, it's really what are the business models and how are we going to pay for all of this and what needs to be done. And I think there's a real opportunity there. So
yeah,
that's where we're seeing things happening. But We'll see. I'll be there next week over the course of the week. I look forward to it. It'll be really exciting because there'll be a lot of people.
Yeah.
And a lot of discussions to be had.
Awesome. Well, Reese, as always, greatly appreciate your insights on the water sector, and thanks so much for coming back on. We'll talk soon.
All right, Dave. Take it easy.
All right. Bye. Well, as always, Reese does a great job giving us some market insights and insights at this point into conference season and what's going on there. Thanks, Reese. Always a good job. And it's time to turn our attention to the feature interview today with Jeff Keitlinger of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. You're really going to enjoy this. As I said at the top of the show, Jeff does a fantastic job explaining in simple terms some resiliency issues and some regionalism issues. So I think you're really going to enjoy this. Get ready for a great interview. So fasten your seatbelts, turn on the valves, and here we go. Well, Jeff, welcome to the Water Values Podcast. So glad you could come back on. The last time you were on back in December of 2017, I don't know that we did the full introduction where you got to tell us a little about your background and how you got interested in water. So could you kind of fill us in on that? Yeah.
And always fun talking to you. So I was originally out of law school. I decided I wanted to be a criminal lawyer, and I was a prosecutor for a while, and that became a little bit like, to my mind, a little whack-a-mole. Over and over and over again. And I then started working on other aspects of government work and started helping cities with planning. And I really became interested in environmental issues, and I worked on things like solid waste issues, sewer issues, Clean Air Act issues, mainly at the city local government level. And then I got approached by the Metropolitan Water District, and I'd never worked on clean water issues, and it was sort of, and I thought about it, and I said, well, that's interesting. That's sort of a hole in my resume, but I like natural resource issues. So I started working with the Metropolitan Water District 10 years after I'd been a lawyer. And became into their general counsel's office, started working on water rights. And I'm a history major out of college, and so I love history. And I found water law is the perfect because it really is the history of California, and the whole West is really the history of the development of water. You know, you don't develop if you don't develop your water supplies, and it's all intertwined in history. And it's been a perfect fit for me, and I've been doing it now for the last 25 years.
Terrific. And you're still at Metro, right? So tell us a little about the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, you know, in terms of geographic scope, volume of water, things of that kind. What are you pushing out there?
Now, Metropolitan Water District, when I joined them in 95, I got to learn their history, and it's a fascinating institution. Originally, City of Los Angeles started to develop in the Los Angeles area, the southwest corner of California. And City of Los Angeles originally started developing and pretty much ran out of water in the 1900s and went to the Owens Valley to develop its own water supply. Famously, William Mulholland basically bought up the valley, developed the aqueduct, a marvelous piece of engineering, almost 300 miles entirely gravity-fed, delivered water in 1913. And he knew that wasn't going to be enough supply forever. And so already in the 1920s, he started looking around and decided to go to the Colorado River as the next source of supply for Los Angeles. And they didn't have enough money to pull it off. They needed to actually bring in more of Southern California. And the concept then became form a consortium of cities. And 13 cities banded together and became the Metropolitan Water District in 1928. And these were places like Beverly Hills, Santa Monica, Glendale, Burbank, Anaheim. They all came together and formed Metropolitan, and they built the Colorado River Aqueduct. And that started delivering water to Southern California in 1941. And slowly but surely, the region grew and all annexed to Metropolitan. And again, we started needing new sources of supply. And in the 1950s, we looked to Northern California. Teamed up with Governor Pat Brown in 1960 to develop the State Water Project, which got water from the Northern Sierras and brought it all the way down to Southern California and the Central Valley. And so those are our two main sources of supply, the Colorado River and our Northern California Sierra supply. They supply about 55% of all of Southern California's water. The rest of our water is local water. our groundwater basins and our rainfall. And we typically sell about 1.8 million acre feet of water a year. We deliver about little less than a couple billion gallons of water a day, about 5,000 acre feet of water a day. And so those are our two main sources of supply. It's a lot of water. And as Southern California has grown, we continue to annex. We now are starting Ventura County, Los Angeles County, Orange County, parts of Riverside and San Bernardino County, and all of San Diego County. That's 19 million people we deliver water to, one in every two Californians, or put another way, one in every 16 Americans.
Wow, that's some incredible scope. I found it interesting about the diversity of supply with the Colorado River, the Northern Sierras. In terms of supply diversity, how are you going about looking at ensuring a diverse supply for the future to get the additional water supplies the metro area is going to need?
If you look at kind of the history of development, every 30 years, Southern California's had to go out and get a water supply. 1900s, they went to the Owens Valley. 1930s, the Colorado River. 1960s, Northern California Sierras. And in 1990s, we ran out of water and had to do severe rationing and realized that pretty much every 30 years, we have to add a new supply. But the lesson we learned in the 1990s is we're the era of going somewhere and building 1,000-mile aqueducts and damming up new rivers is pretty much over. And, we looked around, but that's just not really possible. And so we kind of reinvented ourselves in the 1990s. Up until the 1990s, we did all the water importing, and we left everything else to our local agencies to handle conservation, recycling, groundwater basin management. So starting in the 1990s, we pulled together our first integrated resources plan where we looked at all the resources in Southern California. We tallied them up and integrated them and started planning and figure out where to invest next and how to invest in that. And so we figured out what our growth rate was going to be, how the demands were going to grow, and where we would find the new supplies and how we would fund them. So we started looking at, okay, we expect to conserve this much water over the next 25 years. We expect to grow recycled water by this amount over the next 25 years. We need to invest in our groundwater basins and clean them up. And we've set targets for each of those areas. And we revisit the plan. It's a 25-year look ahead, but we revisit it every 5 years. And it's been remarkably successful. So when we first started going down this path in 1990, Metropolitan sold 2.4 million acre feet to serve 14 million people. Today, we serve 19 million people and do it with 1.8 million acre feet. We've lowered our demand roughly by a quarter, and we've added about 25% more people. And we've shown we can uncouple growth from water supply. We can keep our demands relatively flat while we continue to grow our economy and our population. And that's been a real success story. The challenges, though, are we have to keep doing it. It's worked for the last 25 years, but it's obviously we're going to add. California is supposed to go to 50 million people, Southern California to 25 million people over the next 20 years, and we're going to have to find the supply for that next tranche of people. And again, we can do it, we believe, in recycled ocean desal, brackish water cleanup. But we also have to hang on to those imported supplies. Basically, we have to do all of the above all the time.
Right. And so the conservation movement is interesting. Are there specific programs that you've identified that are very successful or more successful than others in helping you conserve all that water?
Yes. Originally, we decided to focus in the house, and pretty much every toilet now in Southern California has been changed out to either low flush or ultra low flush. All new construction has to have it, but we've gone and retrofitted pretty much everything. The same thing with shower heads. We did the same in kitchens. We did the same. We've started doing dishwashers, clothes washing machines. Mainly we did that with rebates. Originally, as I said before, we had left that to cities, but we found you ended up with a hodgepodge of programs. Los Angeles would do something and San Diego would do something differently, and Anaheim and Glendale would have different programs. And so we kind of brought them all in-house and regionalized all of Southern California so that everybody, whatever hardware store you went into, would have access to the same kind of rebates and the same sorts of programs. And so by, you know, taking it across geographic boundaries and political boundaries, it really helped drive conservation. But what we found is, you know, it's like anything. We're now squeezing harder and harder and getting less and less. And you have to, you know, we've taken all that low-hanging fruit and picked it. So we're now focusing on, still on indoors, on sort of high-end products, mainly clothes washers and dishwashers. But we're really pushing outdoors. And in this last drought, we put our outdoor program on steroids. We typically do about $25 to $30-40 million a year across all of Southern California in conservation. And in the drought, we always have a piggy bank set aside, a nice big trust fund for buying water. There wasn't any water to buy in California in 2014-15 when our drought hit unprecedented levels. And basically, we took all our reserves and put it into conservation. We've spent roughly $350 million, a 10 times increase from $35 million to $350 million in a two-year period on having people rip out lawns. Wildly successful. We removed 170 million square feet of turf in Southern California in 2 years. And even though it may not have resulted in huge swings in water supply right away, it really woke up the public to, you know, dealing with the drought. It was the response was amazing.
Yeah. And what about non-revenue water? To the extent that you can incentivize your customers, those constituent water utilities for all those municipalities, are there ways to provide that incentive for them to reduce non-revenue water?
Primarily, we've worked with our cities. You know, we're the wholesaler. So we've worked with our cities on dealing with non-revenue water, primarily with technology, getting them the resources where they can look at leak detection. We're a little bit lucky here in Southern California and, you know, different from the East Coast in the sense that a lot of our development was later. So we do have some older communities like Los Angeles where they have maybe 50 to 80-year-old pipes, but a lot of our areas, the Orange County regions, a lot of San Diego region, we're talking 30-year-old supplies. And so non-revenue water leaks and system leaks, less an issue in Southern California than it is in other areas.
Yeah, and I bet the change in seasons, like here we have, in where I am in the Midwest, there's a big, you know, freeze-thaw that causes the ground to shift and the pipes can get damaged that way, which I don't think you're going to be dealing with down there in Southern California.
No, we have the stable climate. We do have earthquakes,
though. Yeah. Well, let's that brings, that's a great segue to get us into kind of how you're building a resilient supply and a resilient delivery infrastructure system. You know, how do you deal with climate change and, you know, the risk of seismic activity, that kind of thing? What kind of programs or design is in place to you know, look forward and make sure that the supply is resilient into the future?
It's been a real area of focus for us this last decade, probably the last 15 years. California has gone through pretty severe drought from 2006. One of our main sources of supply, the Colorado River, has been in drought since 2000. Almost, we're moving on towards 20 years. And the new science is showing some of this drought's permanent. It really is being driven a lot by climate change. We've had a couple of recent years on the Colorado River that were average precipitation, but we're only getting about 90% runoff. And really digging into it, you know, trying to find where did that 10% of water go. It's really being lost to the system due to higher temperatures and early onset of spring, more plants coming into bloom, taking up water, and so it's never even reaching the runoff. It's never reaching the reservoirs. So we've really been rethinking how, as we move into a climate change world, also we know we're in a seismic world, how do we deal with those, you know, a gradual shift or a dramatic shift? And part of our strategy, probably our main strategy, has been really beef up our storage. We know we're still going to have incredible wet years periodically, but rather than just sort of let those go by, we're going to grab as much water as we can in the big wet years and store it away for what we know are going to be 4, 5, 6, 7 dry years in a row. And So in the 1990s, Metropolitan only had the ability to store maybe 500,000 acre-feet of water in Southern California. We now have the ability to store, in Southern California and outside, about 5 million acre-feet. We've grown it tenfold. It's come at some price. We've spent billions of dollars on these programs, but we've built reservoirs, we've built plumbing into it, we've expanded our well system with groundwater basins, and we've entered partnerships with the United States so we can bank water in Lake Mead, also bank water throughout the Central Valley in California with ag districts. All that has really saved us. In this last decade, we probably would have been at somewhere 50% or more rationing. We would have looked a lot like Australia during their millennial drought or perhaps even Cape Town, but we had these huge reservoirs of storage that really cushioned the blow. So when we went into a drought in 2006, Metropolitan had 3 million acre-feet of water in storage. We got it all the way down to below a million, had a big wet year. We shot right back up to 3 million, pulled it all the way down to a million acre-feet again, and 2017 was the wettest year on record after 4 years of record-breaking drought, and we've refilled our reservoirs again. And so that ability to have the plumbing and storage is really the key to a climate change world.
Yeah. And one of the other things that climate change, at least from some of the literature I've read, is with drier conditions, there's a larger chance of wildfires. And I know that impacts water quality. Do you have any thoughts on, because I know that it seems with greater frequency there are reports of wildfires and actual wildfires in California. How do you deal with that? And what issues do the wildfires cause?
Huge issue for California as a state and the whole Southwest. We used to think of our fire season as starting in August and kind of going through October. You know, the tail end of summer and at the end of the heat after everything's dried out. And now we're pretty much learning that our fire season is looking year-round. We maybe sometimes get January, February off, and maybe sometimes March, and that's about it, because it's just getting hotter and drier all the time. And as it gets hotter, things dry out, and they just burn. And then, you know, lack of precipitation means that everything dries out and there's a lot less green foliage. So it's going to be a huge management issue, particularly in our watersheds. We're pretty concerned about what eventually that's going to do to our water supply. Up till now, it hasn't seemed to have had water supply impacts. There are some quality impacts we're seeing. Certainly, our reservoirs have been silting up more as runoff. There's been ash that gets into it. Not overly dramatic, and the actual supply, again, not huge impacts. But huge impacts and concerns for the state of California. We set aside they fund our firefighting program. They ran out of money this year in August, which is almost before the start of the season.
Wow.
And had to go back, and had to go back and get emergency funding from the state to fund it through right now, which is really start of our real fire season here.
Yeah. Let me follow up on a point I tried to make earlier. Is there any way to develop a resilient water supply from a seismic activity or resilient infrastructure from the seismic activity perspective? I'm just kind of curious about that issue.
We've given a lot of thought to it, and we've settled on we have to have a pre-event strategy and a post-event strategy. So pre-event, we're always studying, particularly about every decade, you have a pretty major earthquake, and then we always take a hard look at everything we've learned. We've also taken lessons from Japan and elsewhere around the world that have a lot of experience. So we look at our critical places, and harden them with the best technology we have. We budgeted over this decade close to $300 or $400 million in just seismic retrofitting of our critical infrastructure, where we know we can't afford for it to go down for long periods of time. And we're, looking around the world, what's the best technology for hardening? Right now, we're looking at a lot of our key main pipes and borrowing some technology from Japan, where they've put in. You hear lots about flexible pipes on the small scale, 1-2 inches. These are 6 and 8 foot pipes that have flexible and bendable joints, and we're experimenting with that as well. All that's our pre-event strategy, but we know at the end of the day, when we get a 7.0 or greater earthquake, no matter how much we harden, there's going to be pretty significant damage. And so we've built up a lot of resources for a post-event strategy. So we do two things. One is we store water. we always keep 600,000 acre feet. That's roughly 6 months of supply with rationing in Southern California at all times. We don't touch it even during a drought. That's our earthquake water. And if the main aqueducts are severed, we know we can go by 6 months with a water supply that we keep in the region at all times. Then we've built up our own resources. We have a world-class machine shop that can manufacture anything in our system. And we put it out on loan, and we manufacture specialty things all year round. But the idea is that if we lose our pumps on our aqueduct, our 1930-era pumps that have been retrofitted, we know if we go on order, we have to get them from Japan or Germany, and it'll be 6 months before they come. We can't wait that long. So our machine shop can manufacture a brand new pumps to go into our 1930s infrastructure, and we can get it done in weeks. And so we can roll pipe, and we have all that crew standing by that do that. So an example, the Northridge quake in the 1990s knocked out our largest plant, our largest water treatment plant, and that's the second largest in the world, our Jensen plant. And the original estimate was that could be down for 6 months, and our crews had it up and running in 12 days, working around the clock with our own equipment, our own cranes, our own trucks. And so that post-event strategy is very critical, so we know we have the equipment and supplies stockpiled to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, vertical integration as a resilience feature. So that I think that's a great strategy. Let's turn a little bit. You've mentioned the formation of Metropolitan Water and how you've annexed recently. I want to explore regionalism because I think that is becoming a bigger and bigger issue around the country. I've been a big proponent of consolidation amongst utilities just to gain efficiencies, to deal with the labor shortage, things of that nature. I'd like to pick your brain a little on how you get new areas to come on board and become a part of Metropolitan Water. And what do you see as the impetus for those areas coming on board? What are the common issues that you're dealing with? And I'll just stop there because I got a bunch of questions, but I don't want to overburden you right out of the gate.
Metropolitan was built as a regional institution. We really are a cooperative. We started out as 13 cities. We now are 14 cities, one county water authority, and 12 water districts, which are consolidation of cities. And we grew from originally parts of pretty much mostly Los Angeles County to six counties and one in every two Californians. So we started as this regional cooperative, and it made a lot of sense. You should pool your resources. We don't have enough water in Southern California. The infrastructure we have to build to do that is multi-billion-dollar infrastructure, and it just didn't make sense for single cities to go off on their own. We should pool our resources. And so in addition to building the big infrastructure, it made sense that pooling resources, we became the water quality lab, the technical work, the highly institutionalized work for all our members and all of Southern California, so that everybody doesn't have to replicate their own laboratories, their own hydrologists, or their own modeling services. So we started pulling all that together. We're pretty much built to the limits of our geographic scope that you would reasonably see people annexing to us. There's still some infill, there's little pockets added, but not huge growth, I don't predict, for Metropolitan. What I see more realistically in terms of regionalism for us is partnerships. So starting in the drought that we got on the Colorado River, Southern Nevada, Las Vegas region, really started bumping up against the limits of their water supply and looking around. And we formed a really strong partnership and alliance with them. They bank water with us now. When they have surplus water, we pay it back to them when they need it. It was very controversial to start doing. We're not really moving water across state lines. We're exchanging it. They take a little more of our Colorado River water in some years, and we borrow some of theirs when we get into a drought. But it was very difficult to work through all the interstate issues. We now have worked with Central Arizona Project on funding projects together, all three of us. We recently brought in Denver Water to work with us. So you're seeing the municipal areas in the Southwest finding ways to partner and work together. We have a strong innovation program where we look at new water technologies, and we come down and meet once a quarter, And we brought in pretty much all the Western water agencies from the Bay Area, San Francisco, East Bay, Denver, Colorado, Phoenix, Las Vegas. We all have our teams get together and analyze new technological innovations that might be useful and share information across utilities. So a lot of those strong partnerships have been growing. You're seeing more of them. I've noticed in the Bay Area, they did not regionalize like Metropolitan, but they formed a lot of good, strong working partnerships and built inner ties between Santa Clara, San Francisco, Oakland, so that they can have some of the features that we enjoy down here at Metropolitan.
Right. So I have questions, I guess, on the micro level, just kind of within your footprint, and also on the macro level where you kind of identified the Colorado River Basin. I'll start at the micro level. One of the common impediments I see in regionalism is the issue of rates. Everyone's worried the other guy's going to get the better infrastructure, but we're all going to have to pay for his rates and all that. So how do you deal with kind of capital contribution, rate design, things to placate or ensure that your member utilities, that they have faith that they're not going to be the ones who are subsidizing the other communities?
It's a real challenge. We haven't had that. We've had to work through those issues every decade, it seems, at Metropolitan, and it doesn't come easy. Even though Southern California is a semi-arid region and has a lot of continuity in that respect, it's still very different. We have areas that have very productive groundwater basins, a real strong source of supply, and they only need some of their water from Metropolitan. And then we have other areas that don't have the groundwater basins and lower rainfall. And Metropolitan is almost their exclusive source of supply. And so obviously their costs then are very different. And those with groundwater often want to see cheaper water delivered, raw water. Those who have to have old treated are concerned about the cost of treatment. So it's been a tension within Metropolitan. We've always ascribed to a philosophy that whatever is good for one helps everybody. It's a regional benefit. And so that, therefore, if you build a recycling plant in part of the region, Metropolitan should help fund it. We know that recycled water is only delivered to its local residents. It's not moving across all of Southern California. But all Southern California chips in, subsidizes it, helps it get built, because it then frees up water, imported water, for other people to use, and they have more of that resource. But every time, I've not gone a decade without everybody saying, maybe we should revisit that, maybe we should look at it. It's hard for me to keep paying for projects in other service areas. I don't feel I always get that same benefit. And always after we have a long, spirited debate, everyone goes back to, we're going to stick with our philosophy of a regional approach, regional benefits. Everybody pays the exact same price, even though we know geographically some are closer to the end of the pipe or the front of the pipe. We're all going to pay the same and share in that. And so far, that philosophy has held, and it's been 80-some years of that.
Great. And on the macro level, the partnerships you mentioned with kind of the inland utilities, I'll call them, are those just water-sharing agreements, or do you see kind of participation by inland states, inland utilities in, let's say, a desal plant on the coast or some other kind of water supply that will allow have a cascading effect upriver, so to speak?
I think we have to. So right now we're working very closely on the Colorado River, and I think we're on the cusp of completing what we're calling a drought contingency plan. We're facing the facts that starting in 2000, it's been dry essentially every single year for 18 years, and we can't afford to keep waiting for the hydrology to turn around. So we're negotiating a 7-state drought contingency plan, which will call for voluntary contributions of water, cutbacks in water use by all three lower basin states, and that water to be stored in Lake Mead for the greater good. Very difficult negotiation, obviously. Everyone's reducing their own takes and their own supplies voluntarily, but that's a tough negotiation. But at the end of the day, that is a tourniquet. We're just stopping the bleeding. We're not reversing course here. We're not growing the pie, and we have to grow the pie. And the only way to grow the pie is going to be with some of those regional projects like you mentioned. And some of that might be ocean desal for those of us on the coast. Maybe cost sharing. It's extremely expensive. And the impacts then would be here locally on energy and footprint. And so we would get potentially cost sharing from those upstream inland agencies. And then they would have a greater access to some, maybe back off some of our Colorado River demands. That can be done with recycled water. Ag-intensive states. Metropolitan has a very innovative program we're very proud of in the Palo Verde Valley, where we pay farmers to fallow on a rotating basis and free up water for our use. That can be repeated upstream, and then perhaps with our funding, freeing up some of that water from upstream agriculture and shift it around. All these are controversial. All these are difficult because you have all the not in my backyard issues and what are my local impacts and how do we cure them. But that's got to be the way of the future. That's the only way to augment our supply and grow the pie.
Right. So Jeff, you've been very generous with your time. We're coming up on 30 minutes here. Is there anything that I have not asked that you think is important to get across to the listeners? You know, what would be your kind of closing remarks in that regard?
A closing issue I think that's pretty important is how it's important. Water may be local, but we're pretty interconnected, particularly here in the South American Southwest. So people on the Colorado River always focused on the Colorado River and didn't really care much to hear about, you know, Metropolitan's issues in Northern Sierras, our Bay Delta problems, what's going on with the Salton Sea. And this drought has woken us all up that we're all pretty interconnected. Metropolitan was able to work out some deals with Southern Nevada and help them when they got in a pinch, only when we had sufficient supplies in Northern California. We're having an ecological crisis in California's Bay Delta. We're looking at a very complex fix to it that's very expensive and it's controversial and divisive. And I now get comments every time I go travel to Denver and Phoenix. How are you doing on the Bay Delta? We want to see you succeed there because we know, they know that if we're successful there, it gives us the latitude to be more cooperative and to have more flexibility on the Colorado River. And so that interconnectedness of all our water agencies and our utilities has really been driven home the last 20 years in a way that I've never seen before. And I think that's very good for that regionalism that we've been talking about. But it's also a little precarious because you know that problems somewhere else don't stop there. Yet it's up to us to help each other through these through this issue of climate change and the other issues that we're facing.
Great. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. You've been absolutely fantastic filling us in on the issues that the Metro is facing, as well as that whole region, the Colorado River Basin. For those folks who want to find out more about you, about Metropolitan Water, where can they go to get that information?
So you can go to our website. You can look up Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. We also have a website on conservation and Be Water Wise. So those two websites are the best place to look. And you feel free to follow me on Twitter.
You're a great Twitter follower. I love that you don't restrict yourself to simply water issues, which is obviously a big part. But I remember seeing one just the other day where someone had tweeted something about Talking Heads, and you said, "I still have the vinyl." So it's a great Twitter follow. It's very interesting. So
my staff is not so sure about that.
Yeah. Well, again, Jeff, I really want to say thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Jeff Keitlinger of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. And I think you'll agree with me what I said at the top of the show. He does an absolutely amazing job explaining all the different facets of how the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California has built in resiliency from a water supply perspective, from an infrastructure perspective, as well as kind of the regionalism approach and the interconnectedness he talked about. I think that is really important, and he just said it so eloquently. I'm just very impressed, and I really, again, appreciate him taking time out of his day to talk with me about water issues. So, again, Jeff, thank you so much. Well, I would love to hear what you thought about that interview. You can check out the show notes and leave your comments for this session at thewatervalues.com/pod133. Or you can email me. My email is david@thewatervalues.com. You can tweet at me. My handle is at DTM1993. And you can tweet about the podcast using the hashtag water values. And as I indicated at the top of the show, please do me a favor, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, whatever podcast directory you're listening to. And if you want to financially support the show to make sure future episodes can come through, would really appreciate that too. Any denomination is helpful. You go to thewatervalues.com, scroll down a little bit. On most of the pages, I think all the pages, there is a little PayPal button. Look for the little gold button. You click on that, and any denomination helps defray the costs of putting the podcast on. There's hosting costs, you know, both media and web. There's all kinds of costs that you may not think about, but your help to defray the cost of putting on the podcast would be very appreciated. Well, in closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values Podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
You've been listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Thank you for tuning into the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and this podcast does not establish an attorney-client relationship with you or anyone else. Information in this podcast should not be considered legal advice. Further, this podcast is not a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer who finds water issues interesting and who believes greater public education about water issues is necessary. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.